Last class, huh, everybody? You don't have to listen to me for much longer. Our topic for today, the first one, is... Oops, not that. I do have to talk about some of the other important developments here. There's a new debate. Just when you think everything's all cleared up from the Council of Constantinople, a new debate arises. But it's only natural, because after they figured out this three hypostases and one ousia deal, they realize that there's another problem that results from it, okay? And it has to do with the incarnation. Do you know what that is? The incarnation? Well, it's not a flower. All right. The incarnation refers to when Jesus was a man, okay? Jesus as a man, a human being, all right? Now, they settled the question about whether Jesus was God, okay? But what, when Jesus was a human being, how do we reconcile that with the fact that he was with God? I mean, he felt pain and he had to eat and drink. He suffered on the cross. Is that God suffering on the cross? And if all human beings have a soul, did Jesus have one? Right? Being God. So these are the questions that came up. There are two schools of thought on opposite ends of the spectrum, the Alexandrian school of thought and the Antiochene school of thought, obviously from Alexandria and Antioch.
The Alexandrian school of theologians were very concerned about the deity of Christ and the unity of his person, and so they tended to make the human side of Christ less important. They emphasized the unity of his divinity and humanity into one person. The outstanding early spokesman of the Alexandrian position had been Athanasius. This has been for a while now. But the emphasis on Christ's deity and the unity of natures within him into one person aroused the suspicion that the Alexandrians either saw Christ's human side as of little value, or that his humanity had mixed with his divinity and thus had corrupted it, because they're trying to smush the two together, right? Now, the Antiochene school of theologians, they were strongly concerned about the humanity of Christ and the differentiation of his divine and human natures. Okay? They tended to make the human side more important. And for them, it had to do with, if we don't preserve Christ's humanity, all right, if we don't sharply separate his divinity and his humanity, then salvation doesn't work out. Because the salvation scheme says that only by Christ taking on a perfect human nature, all right, and dying as such, could we be saved. All right, so his humanity and his divinity must be kept separate. And they didn't like the idea that the Alexandrians were making that, you know, smushing the two natures into one person. Okay? The outstanding early spokesman of the Antiochene position had been Theodore of Mopsuestia. This differentiation, though, between the divinity and humanity aroused the suspicion that the Antiochenes saw in Jesus two persons, two subjects, two sons. And a lot of people didn't like that, the biggest critics being the Alexandrians.
Now, Apollinarianism and Nestorianism are the most extreme forms of each of those schools. Apollinarianism is the extreme form of the Alexandrian school. Nestorianism is the extreme form of the Antiochene school. So first, Apollinarianism, named after a guy named Apollinarius. Let me write that down. Apollinarius, from Alexandria. Okay, he was a strong supporter of the Nicene Creed. He was a friend of Athanasius, in fact. He was a bishop. Actually, I'm sorry, he was originally from Alexandria, but I guess he was the bishop of Laodicea, which is in Syria. Well, reacting to the Antioch teaching, he formulated a doctrine which stated that Jesus did not have a human soul. Basically, he said the Logos of God took the place of the human soul. Okay? And performed all the functions of the body. You know how the soul animates the body and makes it go? Okay? Well, Jesus didn't have one of those, so instead the Logos was inside him, and that was making him move around. Okay? That was animating his body.
In other words, Christ was divine, completely divine, and not human. This is
from the time of Athanasius before he died. Athanasius, reluctantly, even though it was his friend, decided that Apollinarius was a heretic, and they ended up condemning him at the Council of Constantinople in 381. After that time, the Alexandrians never denied that Jesus had a human soul. All right, but they still take issue with the nature question. Okay, Nestorianism comes from a guy named Nestorius, and that's him up there. All right, and he held the extreme Antiochian point of view. All right, he said that there were two natures, right? But there is a new term that was being used during this period, theotokos, that you see up there. People were throwing this word around a lot, using it as a title of the Virgin Mary. And what it means? Mother of God. All right? Now, he took great exception to this term. He said, no, Mary is not the mother of God. God does not have a mom. Okay? God can't have a mother. She is the mother of the human Jesus. Okay? But that's not God. She's not the mother of God. This upset a lot of people. Wait, are you saying Jesus isn't God? No, he's God, okay? But the man part of him's not. Remember, he has two natures. So she bore a man. She did not bear God. That was his big issue. So he was accused of teaching that Jesus was two persons, okay? He says two natures, but they're saying, oh, you think he's two different people. He's like, no, I don't, but he got accused of that, okay?
The point here with Nestorius is that there's not supposed to be any communication between the two natures. All right, no communication at all. That's the important point. So you can't say that God suffered or that God was born to Mary, because the divine nature and the human nature do not mix with each other at all.
His main antagonist was, as you might guess, a guy from Alexandria, and that's Cyril, the bishop there. Cyril of Alexandria. Cyril wrote to Nestorian quite a few times and tried to tell him that he's wrong. But Cyril came up with the doctrine of the hypostatic union. Almost sounds like a sci-fi term, but the hypostatic union, what is it? Okay, this is actually going to be a powerfully influential theory. All right. He's using the word hypostatic. That's from hypostasis, right? We recognize the word hypostasis. Okay? So here's what he said. The hypostatic union is basically this. There's a union between the nature, the human nature of Jesus, and the divine nature of Jesus. There's a union so that there's only one
person.
Okay? He is fully 100% God, and he's fully 100% human. And together, that equals 100%. Okay? That's basically what he's saying. Because, you know, you got to accept that Jesus is totally God, and you got to accept that he was totally a human being too. So how do you do that? You say he was totally both. All right? That's the doctrine of the hypostatic union. So he's one person. One person, two natures. That's what he says. All right? But not everyone liked this idea, as you might guess. And Cyril and Nestorius went head-to-head quite a bit on this. To make a long story short, they finally held a council. This is the Council of Ephesus in 431. And Cyril got there first with all of his supporters. And, you know, kind of underhanded, but the delegation from Syria did not arrive yet. And mainly all the Antiochian believers, right? All the ones around Antioch had not yet arrived at Ephesus for the council. He's like, well, they're late. We better get started. And they held the council and basically upheld this hypostatic union theory, that this is the correct belief about Jesus and his nature. All right? And then, finally, the Easterners got there, they were totally outraged that he did this. So they set up a rival council and condemned Cyril and this hypostatic union idea and said it was completely wrong. Okay? And then Cyril had some Roman officials come and they held another meeting which said that meeting that the people from Antioch had was completely null and void and it doesn't count, and they upheld the decision of Cyril at the first meeting. Okay? Anyway, this ended with a big schism between the Church of Antioch, which remained loyal to their view, Theodore of Mopsuestia's view, and the Church of Alexandria. Okay? So it didn't work out as well as they had hoped. All right. One less ism, and then you don't have to worry about any more.
Monophysitism. Actually, Apollinarius is often considered the first monophysite, okay? But monophysitism is not dead yet. Another guy comes on the scene who is a big supporter of the one nature idea, just the divine nature. And his name was Eutyches.
Okay? He was a monk from Constantinople. Here's what he said. Christ had one nature. When he was a human being, he had one nature. Okay? He was a single kind of being. And it was simply that he was more divine than human. It's basically rejecting pretty much a lot of the humanity of Jesus. It's making him more divine than human. Okay? He said that his body was human, but pretty much all the rest of him was not. Okay? So he had one nature. He said that, here's his words. He says, the humanity of Jesus was absorbed by his divinity like a drop of wine in the ocean. Okay? So that's how much he's emphasizing the divine nature of Jesus. Okay? You basically could hardly even see the human part. All right? What happened? There was a council. There was a guy that supported this idea, who called a council, a friend of Eutyches, and they called a council, and they maintained that this was the correct view. But then another council was called that condemned Eutyches. Okay, so they kept going back and forth on this. But the robber council of 449 refers to a council at which Eutyches attended, and some of the bishops that supported him, and in which they upheld his view. So the robber council, just remember this as a council that promoted Eutyches' ideas. Okay? Now the bishop of Rome gave it the name the robber council. Okay? Because he said that it was nothing less than robbery that they should hold this council and proclaim this heresy and blah, blah, blah. So it's got a negative connotation, obviously. All right. But this council in 449, they really tried to push this idea of one nature. Okay? That's an intermediate stage. Finally, they get it all sorted out at the Council of Chalcedon. I don't know if you call it sorted out, but they finally get a majority view, and it's going to be supported by the emperor, who is no longer Theodosius I, by the way. It's Theodosius II. Okay? And here is the statement that was made, the creed that was drawn up at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, says this. Therefore, following the Holy Fathers, they always, of course, claim that it goes way back, okay? We all, with one accord, teach men to acknowledge one and the same Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, at once complete in Godhead and complete in manhood. Truly God and truly man. So it's Cyril's idea. Okay? Consisting also of a reasonable soul and body. So he's got a soul and a body. All right? Homoousius with the Father as regards his Godhead. And at the same time, homoousius with us as regards his manhood. Interesting, right? So he's homoousius with God with respect to the divine part of him. Well, it's not a part of him, it's all of him. And also homoousius with us as regards the human side of him. Okay? Then it says, like us in all respects, apart from sin. As regards his Godhead, begotten of the Father before the ages, but yet as regards his manhood, begotten for us men and for our salvation of Mary the Virgin, Theotokos, one and the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, recognized in two natures, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. The distinction of natures being in no way annulled by the union, but rather the characteristics of each nature being preserved and coming together to form one person. Not as parted or separated into two persons, but one and the same Son and only begotten God, the Word, Lord Jesus Christ, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So he is all God, he's all man, and doesn't lose any part of his Godhood or any part of his humanity. Okay? So it's 100% plus 100% equals 100%. Homoousios with God and homoousios with humans. All right? That was the decision, and that creed will be regarded as the true teaching by the church, most churches, up until this day.
Now let's turn to the Church of the East once again. And when I say the Church of the East, just reminding you, I mean the church in the Sasanian Persian Empire. The major developments of the Church of the Roman Empire, ever since the Edict of Milan, starting with the Arian controversy at the Council of Nicaea, and everything that has gone on since then, had no impact whatsoever on the Persian church until after the Sasanian persecution. After the deaths of Shapur II and his successor, Ardashir II, the situation of the Christians over there improved. This is right around the end of the 4th century. Above all, it was the Emperor Yazgird I who sought to ease political tensions with the Roman Empire, and he began to integrate Christians into Sasanian imperial politics. And that's what began a period of diplomatic exchanges between the two great empires. Exchanges in which the Christian leadership of Persia played an essential role. Several Persian diplomatic missions to the neighboring Roman Empire were led by bishops and patriarchs of the Church of the East. We're talking about Persian diplomatic missions led by church leaders. Now, the reason why the Persians did that, they figured, well, it's a point of commonality between the two. Maybe because the Roman Empire is Christian, if we send some Christian delegates over there, they'll respect them more. And likewise, the Roman Empire was represented by delegates at the Persian courts. And most of the Roman Empire's delegates were also Christian. Under the influence of one of these Roman delegations, led by a bishop from the border city of Mafirkat, his name was Marutha, Yazgird I permitted the release of Christians. This is at the very end of the Sasanian persecution, and the rebuilding of churches. Christianity by this time had spread as far as Merv. If you take a look at the map here, it had been a diocese since the second half of the 4th century. Anyway, pretty far into the Persian Empire. The individual dioceses were still not collectively organized in the Persian Empire. But the diplomatic skills of this Bishop Marutha contributed to the very first East Syriac Council, we call it. The Synod of Isaac. This synod or council held under the Bishop Isaac. He was the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon, and it was held in 410. It reorganized the church after the persecutions, and it provided an essential contribution to the establishment of the East Syriac Church, the Church of the East, and also of the primacy of the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon. The impulse for this synod came from Marutha, all right? But it was Yazdegerd I, the Sasanian emperor, who actually convoked the synod, much in the style of what the Roman emperors had done. In the first session of the 40 assembled bishops there, a letter from the Roman leaders was read. Marutha had brought it there. And it was signed by the bishops of Antioch, Aleppo, Edessa, Tella, Amid, and others in that general vicinity, so in the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And it was translated from Greek into Persian, and apparently Yazdegerd had already seen this letter, but it was read at the council. And it included three recommendations, but they're more like they were demands than recommendation. But actually, the synod did adopt them. And here's what the recommendations were. In each city of the Persian Empire and its surrounding region, there should be only one bishop, and he should be ordained by three bishops who possess the full authority of the head of the bishops, the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon. Second, liturgical feasts should be celebrated together and on the same days everywhere in the Persian Empire. That would mean Epiphany, Lent, Easter. I think those were mentioned explicitly in the letter. Evidence at this time still shows that there was no unity in the Persian church with regard to when these liturgical feasts would be held. Okay, and the third recommendation was that the creed and canons of the Council of Nicaea should be adopted by the Persian church. Now, looking at these, the first demand was intended to oppose the double hierarchy that the Christians in the Persian Empire had had. See, as I told you before, for a long time, there were these Aramaic-speaking Christians, and then there were these Greek-speaking Christians who had been deported from the Roman Empire. And they kind of had two separate leadership systems. And so the Roman Christians were suggesting that they combine and unify. Now, when we look at the canons of the Council of Nicaea that were adopted at the Synod of Isaac, they were not simply reproduced exactly as written in the canons of the Council of Nicaea, but they were adapted to the specific situations of the Church of the East. Because a lot of the things in the canons of Nicaea had really nothing to do with the Persian Church, and so they really couldn't relate anyway. And final authority over ordination was granted to the Bishop of Seleucia, Ctesiphon. All right. And so he begins, at least from this point forward, to see himself as the definitive head of the Church of the East. And he got the title Grand Metropolitan and Head of Bishops. Okay. Now, the reason for the primacy of the bishop, for the request for the primacy of the bishop, is that that city was the imperial capital. This was done on political grounds. Okay. There's no mention in the writings from the Synod of Isaac that there was any kind of apostolic origin for the city. You know, Rome at least could claim, well, you know, Peter was our first bishop or whatever, but they made no such claim for Seleucia Ctesiphon. It was just, hey, you know, it was the capital of the empire, so naturally the bishop there should be in charge. So through this council, the Church of the East was to be not only reorganized and centralized, but also brought into harmony with the faith of the Roman Church. Okay? Then, a few years later, because the decisions of this particular synod in 410 didn't take effect everywhere at once, another council was held. This was in 420. And again, it was co-moderated by a Western bishop. He had signed that original letter that was read at the First Council, the Synod of Isaac. And this is what went down. In 418, the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon, Yabalaha I, was the leader of a diplomatic delegation to Constantinople. So he went there, traveled to Constantinople. The purpose of it was simply to try to bring the two churches into harmony with one another as much as they could. the common faith of the churches of the Roman and Persian empires was confirmed there. Then, the bishop of Amid, his name was Akakios, from the Roman Empire, he traveled to the Sasanian capital as head of the Roman delegation, and he supported this synod in 420 that Yabalaha had called. Reasons for the council included not only internal church difficulties, but also the unease among Zoroastrians regarding the growth of Christianity, especially in the higher levels of society. This bothered them. The Zoroastrian priests were nobles, you know, and they didn't like that Christians were getting leadership positions in the Sasanian Empire. So the 12 bishops who met at this council recognized, again, Yabalaha as the head and regent over all of the bishops in the whole Sasanian Empire. And the decisions of the Synod of Isaac were confirmed there. The Council of Nicaea was again accepted. And then, additionally, other councils of the West were accepted, many, you know, from the 4th century. Okay, why would the Church of the East in 420 accept all these Western synods? All right, what did they know of Novatianists and Quartodecimans and Montanists and Eustacians and all these other people that we've discussed in previous councils in the Roman Empire? They don't know anything about them. None of those groups even existed in Persia. None of them were even relevant to the Church of the East. It all reflected a specific context in the Roman Empire. So why did they accept it? Well, probably because of the influence of the diplomatic emissary, Akakios of Amid, who came from Rome. But also, it was probably because they wanted to show, you know, solidarity with the Roman Christians. But it was weird. In the 420 council, the canons and particulars of all these Western councils were just accepted as a whole. There's no recorded reflection on the process. They just said, okay, we'll accept them all. Only in later Syriac traditions will they go back to these councils and look again and analyze all the canons and see if they want to keep them as is. All right, the next development would be the Declaration of Independence. And we're not talking about Thomas Jefferson here, but the Declaration of the Independence of the Church of the East. And this occurred in 424. The persecution of Christians began anew. Toward the end of the reign of Yazgird I, as a matter of fact, when he was getting older, but also especially under his successor, Bahram V. So we're talking about Bahram V reigned from 421 to 438 in that general, between those years. The reasons for this new persecution lay in doubts about the loyalty of Christians during a recent war with the Roman Empire, and also in conflicts with Zoroastrianism. Christianity by this time was no longer limited to the Syriac Aramaic-speaking population, and there were significant conversions in the Persian upper class. There were also disputes at this time, internal disputes in the church over the see of Seleucia Ctesiphon. The bishop, who was supposed to be the head bishop, he was being slandered as a Roman sympathizer and placed into prison. All right. Now, in 422, Bahram V concluded a peace treaty with the Roman Emperor Theodosius II, and at that point, the bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon was released from prison, and he was allowed to return to his monastery because he had a monastery. He was actually interested in resigning. He was done. He's like, I don't want to be the bishop anymore. However, there was a synod at Markabta in 424. There were 31 bishops that participated, six of the metropolitan bishops, so they were the biggies, and they persuaded the bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon to resume his office in order to reorganize the church after these persecutions. This time, and this is the first time after the initial Sasanian persecution, that no Western bishop from the Roman Empire was present to direct or to influence the fate of the council. This had happened in 410 and 420. So this synod of 424 is widely regarded as the occasion on which the Church of the East stated its claim to autonomy. They rejected the idea of right of appeal to the West. Like, we don't have to get the West permission for anything. The Metropolitan Bishop, the head bishop, Dadisha was his name, he gave an address. And in that address, he established that while in the past the Western leaders had been supporters and helpers in a shared fatherhood, he says, with the Church of the East, now, and I quote, persecutions and afflictions prevent them from caring for us as they did before. This is the way he's phrasing it. Consequently, it is up to the Bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon to run the church as he sees fit. And they even made the statement that the head of the Church of the East is head of the church in the same sense that Peter was head of the apostles. So it's expressed in that phraseology that no other Peter then from Rome or Antioch or wherever else was necessary. All right? Since the head of the Church of the East occupies the same level as Peter, then there would be no other earthly authority over him. Okay? So any supervision or intervention by bishops of the Roman Empire should stop. Okay? The Synod also stressed the unity of the Church of the East under its own single head. And at this point, at this council, he was given a new title called Catholicos. Catholicos. That will be the official title of the head of the Church of the East from this point forward. Okay. According to the Synod of 424, any disputes internal to the Church, especially those concerning its head, should not be settled by calling upon other Church patriarchs from outside, but solved within their own sphere. All right. Now I want to talk about the school of the Persians in Edessa. The intervention of the Western bishops, okay, particularly the ones in the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire, ceased with the decision of 424. But that doesn't mean that contact with the Roman Imperial Church was broken off. All right? And Western theological development still found other ways into the Church of the East, and the main way that they did was through the school of Edessa. In Nisibis, and you can see Nisibis on the map there, in Nisibis, at the time of the first bishop from Nisibis that we know, his name was Jacob, he died around 338, there was a school of exegetical instruction headed by a man we call Ephrem the Syrian. Okay? This was at a time when the Romans had control of Nisibis. All right. But in 363, the city of Nisibis fell into the hands of the Sassanians. And so the school of Nisibis was brought to an end. So Ephrem the Syrian fled to Edessa, and he founded a new school there that we call the School of the Persians in Edessa. Now, it can be assumed that as an important intellectual center, Edessa had long had a variety of teacher-student circles for the transmission of theological and philosophical instruction. This can be directly inferred from the diversity of Edessan Christianity. But a school in the sense of a theological academy first acquired stable organization in the 4th century and achieved renown through Ephrem. Okay? And then after Ephrem died, the school still flourished. Its theological training and scholarship attained an excellent reputation. Many Persian students who during the Sassanian persecutions fled to Edessa found it an intellectual refuge, and they were educated there. So Edessa became a gate through which theological developments of the Roman Imperial Church could enter the Church of the East. Now, remember about the controversies I was just telling you about in the first half of the 5th century, these Christological conflicts. They had many severe consequences for Edessa, all right? Where previously the teachings of Ephrem and the early Syriac writings have been authoritative, now, on the basis of a massive translation effort from Greek into Syriac, accomplished by theologians of the school of the Persians, new Christological trends came into favor. And since about the year 430, the school had stood under the influence of Theodore of Mopsuestia, whom I told you about already. All right? Virtually all of Theodore's works were translated into Syriac. Okay? And through that translation, Antioch theology became influential in Edessa. All right? The works of Theodore were enlisted for instruction at the school. So graduates of the school, who during peaceful times returned to the Persian Empire, spread this teaching of the Antioch school into the Sasanian Empire, even before the Council of Ephesus occurred in 431. All right? Theodore of Mopsuestia stands as the classic representative of the Antiochian theology. And since his work was studied intensively at the school of Edessa, it's not surprising that delegates from Edessa opposed Cyril of Alexandria at the Council of Ephesus. All right. Now, about a year after the Council of Ephesus, the bishop of Edessa changed sides and he turned from the traditional Antiochian theology over to Cyril of Alexandria's position. So, as a consequence, there followed a serious controversy with the school of the Persians because the school of the Persians maintained their Antiochian stance. But the bishop of Edessa had the writings of Theodore of Mopsuestia burnt. All right, and he sent one of the respected translators of Theodore's material into exile. Then the writings of Cyril were translated into Syriac, and it became the foundation of the new teachings of the school in Edessa. All right. Well, this bishop died in 435 or so, and things changed again. The translator who had been sent into exile became the successor bishop. All right. And then in 437, a Persian by the name of Narsai became head of the school of the Persians. And Edessa turned once again to the Antiochian theology. Now, the Antiochian position couldn't be maintained in the Roman Empire anymore after the Council of Ephesus, so the Persian school in Edessa was kind of in dire straits. All right? And the school was severely suppressed in the during the bishopric of Bishop Kuri, when he was bishop of Edessa. This was in the 470s and 480s and 490s. And Narsai finally decided to leave town, presumably on account of an attempt to murder him. So he fled, and he went back to Nisibis, where Ephraim had once had the school. Okay. So he goes to Nisibis. And in the meantime, the school of the Persians was completely closed in Edessa. All right. And it was actually turned into a church. The school building was turned into a church. Anyway, the removal of the school of Edessa, all right, was a significant step toward the development of the theology of the Roman Empire in a certain direction. It eliminated the whole Antiochian Christology. Well, what happened? Well, when Narsai fled from Edessa and he went to Nisibis, he was given sanctuary by a former student. And this former student offered to make him the head of a new school in Nisibis. And this is how the school of Nisibis was formed. Narsai's theological genius shaped the content of instruction, and for four decades after that, the reputation of the school in Nisibis was, you know, through the roof. Okay? And it was modeled on the example of the old school of the Persians at Edessa and furthered the Antiochian theology. Okay? Many of the students from Edessa who had gone to the school of the Persians when it was closed fled over the border to Nisibis. And by the way, Nisibis is now held by the Sasanians. So it's in the Persian Empire. And Nisibis developed into an intellectual center, became the theological power station of the Church of the East. In its heyday, it had about 800 students there. And it was there that almost every great East Syriac church leader and theologian received his education. And they learned writing, reading, rhetoric, philosophy, and above all, exegesis of the scriptures. It's a 3-year program of study. Now, Narsai, who stood very much in the tradition of Ephraim the Syrian and was also a vehement supporter of the Antiochian theology, he held Nestorius in very high regard. We know this because he wrote a poem, he was also a poet, where he talks about the three great teachers, Diodore of Tarsus, Theodore of Mopsuestia, okay, and Nestorius. Okay? So Narsai's Christology was very similar to that of Theodore of Mopsuestia, primarily because he was the founder of the school of Nisibis and a Persian theologian. Narsai was accused by the Roman church leaders of being a Nestorian. Okay? And he was held largely responsible for the influx of what they perceived to be Nestorianism into the Persian church. He, of course, rejected the name Nestorian. Well, the next development is that the Antiochian theology of Narsai will be confirmed by the Church of the East, officially in 486. The Synod of Seleucia Ctesiphon in 486 is at which the Church of the East officially adopted the Antiochian theology, and this 486 would be, I guess you could call it, the year of a schism with the Roman Church because of this. All right, the Synod produced the first preserved Christological creed of the Church of the East. Here is the creed, part of it anyway. It said, "Further, let our faith in the dispensation of Christ be in the confession of the two natures of the divinity and of the humanity, while none of us shall dare to introduce mixture, mingling, or confusion into the differences of these two natures. Rather, while the divinity remains preserved in what belongs to it, and humanity in what belongs to it, it is to a single lordship and to a single object of worship that we gather together the exemplars of these two natures, because of the perfect and inseparable conjunction that has occurred for the divinity with respect to the humanity. And if someone considers or teaches others that suffering and change have attached to the divinity of our Lord, and if he does not preserve with respect to the union of the persons of our Savior a confession of perfect God and perfect man, let such a person be anathema." So here, in the two nature terms, the necessity of each of the natures being complete and existing in themselves and not mixing is set forth. All right. However, there's still said to be a bond between the divinity and humanity, a union of the person of Jesus. As with Narsai, here the theology of Theodore of Mopsuestia and the position of the Antiochians, okay, is determinative. Over the course of the 6th century, nearly all the synods of the Church of the East, including Christological creeds displaying essentially the same character, a strict Antiochian Christology, strongly opposed any idea that God suffered. And so, from 486 forward, the Church of the East and the Church of the West will be split on this point and will go their separate ways.
Any questions on that? We're good? We're done. Woohoo! All right. I had to leave out a little bit, but that's it.
Thank you very much.
This is your study guide, so come on up and get it. And we're going to see you on Tuesday, is it? 7 p.m.? In this room. Be there or be square.